minutes, we've got Representative Ledoux, Elton Seaton, Chair Samuels, Representative Gatto, and Representative Olson. The agenda today, first we'll take up HB 197, sponsored by the House Special Committee on Oil and Gas. And I see Representative Corning in the room. We're joined by Co-Chair Ramirez. And then we will move on to HJR 15 after that. So first up, we'll have HB 197. Welcome, Representative Corning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate you hearing this legislation. This is actually going to be familiar territory for some of you, including Representative Samuels. And I thought Dahlstrom was on this committee, but I guess not. But it's a bill that we are advancing on behalf of the House Oil and Gas Committee. It passed out of that committee last week, announced before you and Resources. And basically, this bill here is to correct a problem that was an unintended consequence of House Bill 531 last year. That was the coal bed methane bill. And in the course of trying to put in place, I guess you could say, additional restrictions addressing the coal bed methane industry, we overlooked the fact that certain type of drilling activities will now be required to have oil spill contingency plans. That's basically just means if you're a driller for oil and gas and there's formations where potentially gas could spill out on the surface, for example, you need to provide the state an oil spill contingency plan. You need to also show the financial wherewithal that you can deal with those kind of spills. So what this bill does is it corrects that problem as far as providing an exemption for companies, just strictly gas drilling companies, that are drilling in areas where there's no potential threat for or no risk involved for any kind of oil spills. And the state of Alaska would look at each case individually on a case-by-case basis, namely the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and they would make that determination as to whether there's any threat or risk involved in any potential oil spill. So that's basically it. It just simply provides an exemption for just gas drillers where there's no risk for oil spills. It exempts them from having to produce these oil spill contingency plans. There is no financial cost involved with this legislation, zero fiscal note. We do have support, and there's probably letters reflecting that support in your packets from the industry, as well as the state of Alaska, the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, Dan Seamount, namely. And DEC also supports the bill, and we have Larry Dietrich behind me, who I'm sure would be happy to answer any questions if you have any for him. So with that, that concludes my presentation. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions or refer them to the appropriate individual. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Corning. Are there any questions on the bill? Representative Seat.
Thank you. First of all, in Section 2, we're omitting the explanation that this doesn't apply to gas drilling. Is that correct?
It doesn't apply to gas drilling where oil could be encountered in the course of that gas drilling. If you look at, I'd say line 14 to cite an example here, where there's areas in gas formations that are capable of flowing oil, if it's determined by the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission that the geology is such that there's no potential for oil to be seeping out of the ground as they're drilling for gas, and therefore no potential for oil spills, then they would be exempted.
We have AOGCC online also, if you want to wait.
Okay.
And ask his questions. I'm assuming that just those you have no chance of hitting oil,
right,
then
exactly.
You shouldn't have to have a plan to clean
exactly.
up the oil. Representative Gatto.
Boy, to me it's the determination. You don't know if there's gas down there, you wouldn't be drilling. So you don't know if there's oil down there either. Yes. Or where am I going wrong on this? Because if you don't know, that's the whole purpose behind this paragraph.
AOGCC.
Capable of. Okay, and I guess maybe they can answer that.
Sure. I would like to defer to AGOCC, and I believe Dan Seamount is on the line.
Yes,
was supposed to have been.
Are there any other questions, or would you try to get to the AOGCC testimony? Are you going to be able to stay?
Sure, absolutely.
I just had one other question. Can we on page 3, lines 13, where crude oil does not include natural gas or refined petroleum products, and I just wanted some explanation that we're not permitting pipelines that are taking refined petroleum products and not having them have a contingency plan.
Okay.
Or, I'm wondering if that's what this bill does.
Okay.
And I'm just having trouble following.
All right. If it's all right, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have Mr. Seamount to provide that clarification. I'm sure he could explain it a lot better than I could. Did he disappear offline?
Yeah.
I'm stuck now.
You want to take a brief at ease?
Or Larry Dietrich. Larry, would you?
One second. Also, Representative Crawford has joined us. We're right, just started the discussion, Representative, on HB 197.
Okay.
And we just had the sponsor give an overview of that. Mr. Dietrich, would you be available to answer some of these questions, or would you rather defer to Mr. Seamount?
Go to Mr. Seamount, and if any
left
would be glad to help out.
Okay. And I'm assuming when he comes back online, I'll just get a heads up from over here. But in the meantime, if you want to come on up and. So you heard Representative Seaton's questions?
Yes, I believe I did.
Okay.
Were you going to go to Mr. Seamount first?
I don't think he's back online yet. So we're passing the buck right along to you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, yeah, for the record, my name is Larry Dietrich, and I'm the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Department of Environmental Conservation. With regard to the first question, I would defer to Dan. AOGCC is the state's expertise in evaluating formations and determining their oil and gas potential. And so the legislation, as it's written here, defers to them to make that judgment call on whether or not oil would be present in a proposed operation. They issue the permits to drill. They make that determination. Just based on my own memory, I cannot recall a situation where they made a determination that didn't come out the right way. If indeed they determined there was no oil present and there was oil present, they would still be required to file a contingency plan financial responsibility. It'd be later in the process, granted, but the requirement would still be imposed if at such time as they completed drilling, oil was determined to be present. Furthermore, if the plan wasn't in place and they thought oil wouldn't be present, but let's say they drilled, oil was present, they had a spill, there are separate state statutes that still require them to immediately respond, contain, and control the cleanup. So I think we're covered on both bases for that question. The second question with regard to crude oil, I think that's just a clarification to make sure that in the definition, crude oil does not include the natural gas. They're trying to separate these things so that when to make it clear that the exemption only applies to the gas-only situations. And that, I believe, is the intent of that definition. Its purpose is to clarify that.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
And, Mr. Chairman, yeah, that was my concern, is that crude oil does not include natural gas. I don't have a problem with that. But then we have ore refined petroleum products. And if we're exempting pipelines that are carrying refined oil products from having an oil spill contingency plan, I would have a problem with that. And but I'm not sure if that's the effect of the bill.
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. Yeah, the intent of that bill, there are no other categories of the regulated facilities that would be exempted by this other than the gas exploration activities. So the scenario that of a refined petroleum product pipeline, say, or oil storage tank that's currently regulated would still continue to be regulated.
Yes.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. So do we need on this line refined petroleum products if we're just trying to distinguish between crude oil and natural gas? I mean, to me, it becomes confusing if we're talking about exemption from oil spill contingency plans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and we're combining natural gas and refined petroleum products, which I don't believe is what we wanted. I don't believe that's the intent of the bill, but I want to make sure it's not the way the bill comes out.
If you have a jet fuel pipeline from A to B, it's not covered under this set of statutes anyway. It's covered under a separate set of statutes?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, the jet fuel pipeline, if it were covered, would be covered under 86460. And Breck Tops, then from the Department of Law, may be signed up.
Yes, he is.
He participated in the drafting, and he may be able to give, I think there's just a technical reason why they need to clarify that definition. If Breck's online, he may be able to address Representative Seed's point clearly.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Dietrich? Do we have anybody else online yet?
Whole system is gone down.
We've got either Mr. Tostevin from Department of Law in Anchorage or Mr. Seamount from AOGCC. Is there anybody online that can hear us?
Yes, Mr. Dietrich, a question.
Okay, we'll continue on. Mr. Gatto.
I'll get on
or Mr. Dietrich.
page 3, line 13, definition of crude oil does not include natural gas.
That's the question we're looking for.
Well, no, just the statement on itself. Isn't natural gas always part of crude oil? Is it possible to get it out of the ground without natural gas in it?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, natural gas is separately defined in 4604-900, and that's the intent, I think, of the technical changes here is to distinguish between these so that it doesn't apply to the shallow gas wells. And natural gas is a standalone definition, means a hydrocarbon at 70 degrees Fahrenheit and atmospheric pressure in a gaseous state. So it's specifically designed to only include gas itself. I mean, it is a component of crude if it comes up.
Yeah.
But for purposes of applying the exemption, it would be left out.
Representative Seaton?
Yeah, thanks. On page 3, line, 25, 26, I see, except that oil does not include natural gas. I can understand that. Now on page 4, lines 18, 19, we have that same terminology, except that oil does not include natural gas. And then we have this different definition on page 4, line 7, again referring to natural gas or refined petroleum products that we had before. And so I guess I'm still confused.
I think what we'd like to do perhaps is we'll set the bill aside and we'll move on to HJR 15 until we can get Mr. Tostevin and Mr. Seamount online, and they can answer some of these questions. If there's any questions that Mr. Dietrich or Representative Coring can answer right now, then we'll continue on with this. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. I guess I heard one statement about non-conventional gas, but this is any gas, isn't it? It's not just non-conventional gas. Or is this just non-conventional gas that we're talking about in this bill?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. Yeah, this deals with the non-conventional gas primarily because that's a thing that was inadvertently changed last year. And so this fixes that so that the non-conventional gas wells would not be required to have a contingency plan. And it's true that regular conventional gas wells also that do not have oil also do not have to have a contingency plan.
Okay, and so a follow-up?
Yeah.
So then this conforms, the intent here is to conform the non-conventional to the current procedures for conventional gas?
That's
conventional only.
Yes, Representative, through the chair, that's correct. And these definitions are technical changes to make sure that everything in the statutes have been changed is consistent with that.
Any other questions? Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Page 2, line 8, the language deleted. It looks pretty clear in the deleted language that it does not apply for a facility used solely to explore for, develop, or produce non-conventional gas. And we wanted to delete that. I guess I need some explanation of why we want to delete that subparagraph.
Yes, Representative Gatto, through the chair. Yeah, the change made by HB 531, narrowed that definition of non-conventional to the gas wells, and that was the problem area. So that's why they deleted it, and it's replaced then with the language, which is all new in Section 1, So they deleted the reference to non-conventional, which was changed by H531 to have a different, it narrowed it from its originally broad thing, which would have continued to allow gas wells to be exempt. So when it narrowed it down, it implied then that contingency plans would be required for the non-conventional or the cold bed wells, and that's what they're trying to fix. And the way they've fixed it now is by introducing the language in the whole of Section 1, which substitutes for that deleted language in Section 2, a provision whereby AOGCC makes the determination whether or not gas is present in any given situation, and or makes determination whether or not oil is present in any given situation, and if it's determined that it's not, if there is no oil present, then no contingency plan would be required. So 2 was essentially deleted because it's replaced then by the new language, which brought that definition out in Section 1, which includes then the exemption for the non-conventional or the cold bed methane wells.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coyne.
I'd like to just make 2 brief remarks, not directly related to Representative Gatto here. I had not answered Representative Seaton's previous question as far as what was my intent with this legislation. Did it involve refined petroleum products? And the answer is no. And if it's the desire of the committee to clarify the language, particularly on line 13 and page 3, I'm certainly amenable to that. And then the second one is that just in proofreading this legislation, just a very technical issue, very small technical correction here, and that is on page 4, line 1. We've got to insert the word 2 on that first partial sentence there, where it says facility will not penetrate a formation capable of flowing oil the ground surface. It should say to the ground surface. So I'd appreciate the committee making that change.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Dietrich or Representative Coyne?
If you were not required to have a contingency plan for and you hit oil, who's responsible then?
Through the chair, if you're not responsible for having a contingency plan, you hit oil. Number one, this provision applies to any operator that would apply to drill a well and get a permit to drill. So, in the course of applying to AOGCC for that, a determination was made that there was potential for hitting oil. They would be required during the application process and to submit an application for an oil spill contingency plan.
But what if it was determined there wasn't a need for one and they did hit oil?
Through the chair, yeah, if they determined that no oil was present and they did not apply for an application and then did hit oil, then at that point, two things would happen. They're still required under separate provisions of law to immediately respond, contain, and control up any oil that is spilled. And number two, the requirement then for financial responsibility and contingency plan would still be invoked. It still applies.
So you don't have to go through the expense of the plan. If AOGCC says you're not going to hit oil, and we trust them to know what they're talking about, and if they're wrong, then you have to come up with the plan then anyway. So you have to go through the expense of the permitting process or whatever the process is after you hit the oil. So, okay.
Yeah, that's correct, Mr. Chairman. The idea of the plan, this has nothing to do with the underlying responsibility to respond to a spill is in place regardless of whether you're a facility that's required to have a contingency plan or not. The laws that were passed to require a contingency plan were passed for specific situations where the risk was high enough that you wanted an element of preparedness in place ahead of time, and that's essentially what the contingency plan is. It causes an operator to prepare an oil spill contingency plan before they start their operation so that the plan, the resources, the equipment, the personnel, the training is all in place before they start that activity. So it requires a level of preparedness that isn't there in theory if you did not prepare a contingency plan.
Okay, we're still down on the
modern
technology here. So if there's no other further questions, we'll do this. We can set the bill aside and move on. Do you have people testifying online also?
I don't think so.
Okay. We will set the bill aside. We will, I assume this is being worked on.
We had to go to the milk tax.
No, we're not going to the milk tax.
Be fast.
We are going to HJR 15 right now, which is relating to open season aquaculture in the federal exclusive economic zone. It's by the House Special Committee on fisheries, and Mr. Fisk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ian Fisk, staff to Representative Thomas and to the Fisheries Committee. It's open ocean aquaculture, but today I guess we'll have open season on open ocean aquaculture. There is legislation pending in front of Congress. It's in draft form that would allow the Secretary of Commerce to set up an open ocean aquaculture program. And this has the fishing industry in Alaska very concerned, to say the least, especially in light of our recent experience with the growth of salmon farming and what that has done for our coastal communities. The concerns that the industry has are numerous. In terms of the biological concerns, these include disease transmission, the use of antibiotics, potential damage to the environment due to anoxic conditions created by overfeeding, which has been a problem that's beset the salmon farming industry in various places. There are concerns about the health ramifications of farmed fish to those who consume them, and escapes into the natural environment of non-native species. We've seen salmon that have escaped from British Columbia farms as far west as the Alaska Peninsula, for instance. And there are further concerns about the use of genetically modified organisms. So those are some of the biological concerns. Furthermore, there's a lot of socioeconomic concerns in terms of what open ocean aquaculture is going to mean to our existing fisheries and to the communities that they support. We have numerous successful fisheries in the exclusive economic zone, which, just to review, is from federal waters from 3 miles out to the 200-mile limit. And our existing fisheries are soundly managed for biological and economic sustainability. They maximize the resource value. They are primarily, the participants in those fisheries are Alaskans, and much of the economic benefit from that resource is landed in our ports. And a lot of the value is realized by not only the communities and the businesses there, but also by the state through the taxes that we impose on the fishing industry. As you all know, the legislature in 1990 instituted a ban on finfish farming in state waters. This resolution will make, you know, proposes that be consistent in federal waters. So I think since 1990, we've seen that the international fish farming industry has caused quite a bit of harm to our fisheries, but we're also starting to see the benefits of sticking to our guns, and that is that Alaska has carved itself a niche in the world market, and that's starting to produce better fish prices based on the products that we produce, which are natural, healthy, and have really, you know, we've made a name for ourselves. So I'll call your attention to the resolves, which I guess in any resolution is really what it's all about. The CS that you have before you adds in a resolve on page 2, line 27, stating that the legislature opposes open ocean aquaculture for finfish and predatory shellfish in the waters off Alaska. Furthermore, the other resolves apply not just off the waters of Alaska, but the legislature urges Congress to prohibit the use of genetically modified fish, and that would apply to such proposals anywhere in the U.S. EEZ. And we state our support for the regional fishery management councils, which were created by the same act that produced the exclusive economic zone to begin with, the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and request that the councils, and this is also a little bit of a strengthening of the language after it came out of the Fisheries Committee, that requests that the councils be granted authority over any proposals regarding open ocean aquaculture in federal waters. With that, I will conclude my presentation and take any questions you may have.
Okay. Any questions for Ian? Senator Seaton?
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to move the CS version Y to before us.
Version Y?
Version Y.
Okay.
Okay. Any objection? Hearing none, version Y is adopted and before us. Are there any questions for Ian? We've got him here. Representative Seaton?
Yes, I had a good one on the, on page three.
I have yours.
Lines, line nine. I guess I'm unsure as the, we're requesting a EIS as required by law. I mean, is, are we, I guess I'm not quite sure what we're asking them to do. We're asking them to just be sure that, that open agriculture isn't exempted from any EIS that's currently required?
That's correct, through the chair. Representative Seaton, the, apparently the administrator of National Marine Fisheries Service has said that an EIS would not be required. And this is saying that the reference as to required by law is the National Environmental Protection Act. And a legislative environmental impact statement would say that, I believe it's worded that within 30 days of introduction of legislation in Congress, that an environmental impact statement must be performed so that it can be a part of discussions as it goes through Congress. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Yes, it does.
Any other questions for Mr. Biss?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Page 2, line 29. I think that's the same one. No, on the... Got to make sure I have the... I'm trying to refer to cultivate cells or otherwise handles genetically modified fish. And on the work draft, that might not be 29. I don't know if it is or not.
Yeah, it is.
Line 30.
Okay. If this prohibits genetically modified fish, and that's, I think, what this is after, what would happen, though, if we wound up with devastating diseases to the entire stock and the virtual elimination of any kind of fishery? But it was possible, with the introduction of a gene, to build some resistance into the fish. This prohibits us from saving our own fishery.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I think, you know, looking at the history of our stocks, halibut, salmon, and so on, they're very biologically diverse. In other words, they cover large, you know, they're ubiquitous in the Gulf of Alaska and the coastal streams. In the case of salmon, I could certainly try to get an answer from you from the Department of Fish and Game as to the risk of such an event, but I would consider it very small. And I think the bigger risk is if we allow genetically modified organisms in the first place into net pens, which are prone to failure, as has been proven countless times in the existing aquaculture industry. We're more likely to see threats to the natural stock based on the introduction of unnatural fish.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you said prone to failure if we try to do... If as they do aquaculture, that the genetically modified fish fail?
No, excuse me, through the chair, Representative Gatto, that they would propose, they would present a threat to the natural stocks if they escape from. When I said prone to failure, I meant the net pens themselves. Yeah. And we've seen the escapes that I spoke to earlier of lots of farmed fish from the farms in British Columbia. If we allowed genetically modified organisms, in my opinion, we're just playing with fire.
My concern is, you know, we've already caught Atlantic salmon here. No doubt we have British Columbia fish here. I'll tell you, the concern is only that the way biological systems go, you introduce a predator, and they're very efficient at what they do, and especially when you have this incredible food supply. If indeed we had something that was so attractive to a predator that we were simply losing so many fish that there wasn't any sense to fish anymore, but we could make the fish bigger so they couldn't eat it, or make the fish resistant to a bacteria or a virus or so they wouldn't die from it. Wouldn't that be detrimental if we said, yeah, you can't save the fish by saving them? That's the concern that I see in that one statement.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I guess the concern that you're raising is so nightmarish, I almost don't know how to respond to it. I mean, it's, if we get to the point, and not to belittle your point, I'm sorry, but I'm saying that if we get to the point where our natural stocks are to that level of depletion, I'd hate to think that we'd have to engineer the entire response to it.
What I'm thinking is, you know, the sturgeon? No, not the sturgeon. What's that killer fish in the lakes?
Pike.
Oh. Yeah. Look at how effective the pike are. I mean, it's just incredible. They're good at what they do, and they enjoy doing it. And if indeed we had a pike-like situation where we're just losing our stocks like crazy and somebody says, there isn't any way to save these guys, unless, and I have a thought, that if we modify them, we can. And so nightmarish or not, we're making legislation that could make a nightmare. That's what I'm concerned about.
Representative Rammer.
Yes, thank you, and I appreciate your Frankenstein concerns and the STD fish scenario. My question deals with how much of a premium does Alaskan-grown product enjoy over farmed fish product? Do you know what kind of a range that is?
That's a good question, Representative. I don't have the numbers in my head about what, you know, like first wholesale price for farmed fish, but I mean, in many cases in stores, Alaska fish sells for considerably, you know, I would guess 40% to 50% more than farmed fish. And it depends, you know, we're talking about salmon, but in this open ocean aquaculture proposition, you know, any number of other species could be introduced and farmed as well. You know, I don't know exactly how it would play out in the halibut market, but we demand our fish get a premium price because of the most important thing here is because of the name association and the inherent quality that our system produces. I mean, our whole management system is considered world class, and I think it would be really detrimental to tamper with that, confuse the marketplace by associating open ocean aquaculture unnatural systems with our own.
Is there a size at which a fingerling becomes a you know, a fish that's grown in a fish hatchery, say at DIPAC down here in Juneau? They release, I think, 100 to 120 million fingerlings that are anadromous fish into the ocean. And at what point do they become a farm fish product? Because presently the DIPAC people told me that it's considered wild stock that they're releasing in there. Do you know at what point, like a catchable fish, it's 90, 100 grams, but the fingerlings are like a 1 or a 2 gram fish. At what point do they become a farmed fish? Do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, at what point do they become a farmed fish? I guess at no point would they be considered farmed, and that's what distinguishes our hatchery program so clearly from farms, is that they're only, you know, assisted through the very early stages of their life. It's considered a ranching program. I liken it to, I don't know, a very, very large-scale free range, and they're spending their entire adult lives as any other fish would.
Pardon me. When they're in penned, then they literally keep them in a penned-in area. Is that what you mean by the industry that is
yes,
described
sir.
Here?
In a farm, they have to be kept in pens and fed over the course of their lives until they're up to a mature stage, until they're marketable.
Do you happen to know what the yield is on farmed fish? I know with the DIPAC fish that it's like 2% or 3% of the fish they track return out of the 100, 120 million. What for farmed fish, is it a much higher percentage?
Yes, it's definitely a higher return than, because they don't have to compete and behave like a real fish. They just sit there basically like you know, salmon cows, fattening up and living close to each other, festering, getting diseased, instead of being like a real fish out in the ocean competing and becoming robust like our own wild fish.
Who's best at growing frankenfish?
At this point, my understanding is there was one franken salmon grown back in Prince Edward Island. The Canadians have taken it upon themselves to go down that road. I don't know whatever became of it. I hope somebody won the salmon derby with it and we'll never see it again.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Any other questions for Ian? Public testimony, we've got Paula Terrell.
For the record, my name is Paula Terrell, and I am I'm a commercial fisherman, but I'm here on behalf of Alaska Marine Conservation Council, and there are just a couple of questions that or things I wanted to address. The AMCC is primarily, it's an organization that deals with fisheries and resources, and we work with coastal communities and try and keep communities fishing. And most of our board members are commercial fishermen. And thank you very much for hearing this resolution. I do have one comment that I would like to make on page 2, if I may. Line, am I right? Let me just make sure it's the new resolve. I'm sorry, line 27 and 28, line 28. I really support the resolution. The only thing I would like to just throw out as an observation is that I think it would be stronger to just say that Alaska opposes ocean open aquaculture for finfish and predatory shellfish, period, rather than just off the coast of Alaska. And the reason that I'm saying that is I know that we only, that this legislature can only basically speak in many ways to just what is in Alaska. But we have seen with farm fish and after the ban that we instituted in 1990 that we were impacted by states around us that were doing doing fish farming. And so no matter what we say or do, we still have what's around us, and I think it would make it a stronger resolution if we just made it generic that way. And that's, of course, up to the committee, but that was the one comment that I wanted to make. I'm happy to answer questions. All I do with AMCC is work on fish farming and offshore aquaculture. And I don't know, somebody asked about genetically modified or what. Aqua Bounty has a request into the federal Food and Drug Administration to allow genetically modified fish, and they have made it clear that they would like to supply fish farms with genetically modified fish. That's one of the main reasons for including this kind of language opposing genetically modified. It would be an invasive species. So I don't have anything else. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much.
Representative Gatto. I hate to pursue this reasoning on and on and on. But let's just say global warming is real, and the temperature of the water starts to increase, and the salmon are very, very specific, I think, am I wrong, about the temperatures that they'll tolerate. And let's say they want cold water, and they start to get away from us and start moving further and further north to keep cold water, and we start losing the volumes of fish that we have now. And one of the Frankenstein company says, well, certainly possible to make them tolerant to 2 more degrees, but it would require genetic modification. And you could lose your whole industry, or you could do this. Would you do it, or would you support it?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, first of all, the genetically modified is, you're modifying their hormones. I don't know that you're modifying the resistance to disease or other things. But actually, the waters have been getting much warmer. When we were fishing, I'm a southeast troller, water temperature this last year was like 65 degrees. I mean, that's incredibly warm. The salmon were still there. I truly believe that although we sometimes have problems with, or as fishermen, we criticize some of our management, we have world-class management here. We are looked upon as models of our fishery management, and I just don't think that would happen. I think that we would manage, if anything like that possibly could happen, I think we would be managing our fisheries differently. But I really think that it's, I don't see that as a possibility. I really don't. And no, I wouldn't want to see an invasive species. This is something that would I would not want to see.
Representative Kapsner?
Thank you. I don't have a question for you, Paula, but I do want to follow up on this. I know salmon are very sensitive to water temperatures, but my understanding is that the way that they navigate their way from the ocean back upstream is, first of all, through the magnetic pole of the pole, and then through their sense of smell once they get into the main river, up to their tributary or whatever spawning ground they had. But that's not to say that it isn't necessarily linked to temperatures in the ocean, but I don't think so.
Okay. Any other questions for Paula? Thank you very much. Is anybody, are we online at all yet? No? Anybody else in the audience? Charisse, sure you don't want to talk about fish? Jerry, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska. Just to clear up a couple things on the modified in the hatchery fish. Like Paula said, they're putting in for a permit for genetic modified. That shot up with hormones, so it makes a king salmon huge, but its head stays real teeny, so it has the brain doesn't catch up with the body. But that has nothing to do with if our wild stocks. The reason we started our hatcheries was to complement our wild stock. If there was some wild stock that was down or something, the hatcheries that we have in existence right now could go in and take the eggs, cultivate them, and release them just like they are now. It's called ocean ranching. It's not has anything to do with genetic modified. Genetic modified is for not only for fish, it's also there's been some food and it's been banded in different states and European Union on genetic modified food. So has nothing to do with replacing the wild stocks in the state. And then, Mr. Chairman, the co-chair's question on when does a hatchery become a fish farm. Hatchery raises their fish. They got it down to a science to a little about that size. If they held them too long, the timing would be wrong. Plus, they have to release them at a certain time when the plankton bloom is to get them out to come back at the same time. If you start holding them real long, then you run into the risk that the farmers do. Disease, more feed, you know, all these problems that you would have. So you can't hold them for that long. They have to go out at a certain time, so they'll come back at a certain time.
Representative Ramos.
I hope that clears up a little bit.
Do you believe that wild fish have more feelings than farmed fish?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know about that one, but I hear that there's different studies going on, so maybe we'll get a conclusion to the whole story someday.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Just a question. You mentioned that when you modify the genes, the DNA, that it only results in a hormonal change. Is that the gene that's modified to create a hormonal change? Is that it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, that yes, it's to make the fish
growth hormones, right, I guess.
You know, grow real fast.
Yeah.
So, you know, instead of having to wait for a natural king salmon that takes 5 years, the cycle on sockeye and king salmon is 5 years, 1 year in fresh water, and then they go out and they come back in 5 years. They're going to try to raise these things in a year.
Mm-hmm. No, I understood that. I just didn't, I'm just curious to me, I thought maybe what it, just the fact that it's genetically modified, and I'm just trying to determine that, all it affects is a probably growth hormones, be my guess, if it's only hormones. But is it anything else? Because you can genetically modify corn and everything else and make it grow bigger, and it's not hormones. It's something else.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you changed the genetics. Fish have certain genetics, and they go back to certain streams because, like Representative Kastner talked about, they have these two bones in here that has that polar pool that goes back to certain water. If you have genetic modified fish, all you're doing is growing the fish fast. You're not really, you're not going to replace genetic modified fish to help out wild stocks because you'd be changing the whole gene pool of the wild stocks. Each stock has its unique gene pool. And where the hatchery got their stocks was from the wild eggs. All they did is put them in the hatchery and incubate them and get them to a certain size so that they might survive over the wild stocks a little, better, but it doesn't always work. I mean, sometimes the hatcheries have failures, too, that their fish don't come back for unknown reasons. You don't want to change your gene pool by bringing in invasive species, Atlantics, or genetic modified. You'll change your whole gene pool of wild stocks.
Any other questions for Jerry? No? We still have nobody online. Yes.
Well, we're having people online.
It's a GCI problem, and the T1 line's down, but I do have a direct dial with Anchorage, and we have one person there.
Okay, let's finish up. What's the will of the committee on HGR 15? Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to, can we ask Ian another question here?
Certainly.
I was curious on page 3, line 9, can we specify the law in there? That might make that a little clearer. Instead of just as required by law, can we go ahead and specify?
As required by the by NEPA?
Yeah. Well, would that be a friendly amendment to you?
Yeah. I think that would be fine, sure.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion that we change on line page 3, line 9, to read instead of as required by law to as required by the National Environmental Policy Act.
I think it's
for, and I'm making this conceptual, so if I've got the an acronym wrong there, it's not quite NEPA.
Okay. I'll object while they finish consulting there for a second. Is there any discussion on the amendment?
And Mr. Chairman, the reason I make that is because when you read it there, you're saying, well, Congress do this because it's required by law, and at least this comes back to the specificity of where we're, what we want to make sure that the open aquaculture is in conformance with NEPA.
Okay. Does the sponsor have any?
Yeah, the just stating as required by the National Environmental Policy Act would suffice.
Okay, I'll remove my objections. Is there any further objection to amendment number one? Not amendment one carries. Is I guess I would ask you the off Alaska dealings one way or another.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that I mean, personally, I wouldn't mind seeing it banned off of all of federal waters. I think that's up to you guys to say how, to what extent you want to demand that. There's people off of, apparently off of the Gulf of Mexico that want to reuse oil rigs and try to turn them into shrimp farms. As a shrimp fisherman, I'd rather not see that.
Okay. Are there any further amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a dandy amendment.
Okay. The amendment would be to delete the words off Alaska on page 2, line 28.
Was it 28?
I thought it. Mr. Chairman, would it be the entire thing in the waters off Alaska?
Is that the amendment, Representative Crawford?
Wait a minute. I'm yeah.
Is there any discussion on the amendment? Deleting the words in the waters off Alaska? Is there any objection? Hearing none, amendment 2 carries. Are there any further amendments? Representative Ramos?
Yes, sir. Oh, yes. I'd like to move the CS for Hunt Joy House Joint Resolution 15-24-LS0631/Y.
As amended with individual.
As amended with individual recommendations and no and the fiscal note.
Is there any objection to moving HR 15 out of committee? Hearing none.
Thank you.
Harris, thank you, Ian. Okay, we're going to go back to HB 197 right now, and I've been told we can get Mr. Tossman from the Department of Law online. Mr. Tostvin?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
While we're waiting for that, I'd make an amendment, number one.
Okay.
To add the word "to" between "oil" and "the" on page four.
For line one?
Page four, line one, between "oil" and "the," to add the word "to."
Is there any objection to amendment number one, adding the word "to"? Hearing none, amendment one, number one carries.
Say that again for me.
We're adding the word "to" between "oil" and "service," so it will read "capable of flowing oil to the ground surface."
On what page, what line?
Page four, line one.
Okay, thank you.
Amendment one carries. Do you have something you'd like to say, Representative Corrine, or are we going to wait for the online people?
The offense are not here.
Let's take a brief Eddie's. Due to technical difficulties here, we will hold HB 197. It will be first out of the chute on Wednesday.
Chairman, can I make a comment?
Yes.
We were doing some grammatical corrections. In page 3, line 17, the first word, I believe, should have an S on the end of the word. Did I say line 17?
Means.
Page 3, means.
I object. I think it should be singular. Natural gas production facility and natural gas terminal facility mean a platform facility or structure that is used.
You could be right.
I believe he is.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted everybody to consider, I would be thinking, depending upon the testimony we get, of offering an amendment to delete on page 3, line 13 and 14, the words "or refined petroleum products" from there in page 4, lines 7 and 8, and depending upon, so the sponsor can get back to us on that at the next hearing.
Okay, and if I could ask the sponsor to maybe check with Department of Law on why it was phrased that way, and then...
Sure, be happy to do that.
See you on Wednesday.
Absolutely.
Are there any other questions or something we can discuss at this time without AOGCC or Department of Law online? Okay, we'll hold the bill over until Wednesday. It'll be first out of the chute on Wednesday. Mr. Pound just handed out some definitions, which you might read over, which tell the difference between natural gas and crude oil. You might review those. And if there's no other business before the committee, we are adjourned at 2:47.
Thank you, Chairman.